Why shall I shall not be moved? I shall not be moved. I'm like a tree planted by the water. I shall not be moved. Oh, children, I shall not be moved. Oh, children, I shall not be moved. I'm like a tree planted by the water. And I shall not be moved. I'm on my way to heaven. I shall not be moved. On my way to heaven, I shall not be moved. I'm like a tree planted by the water. And I shall not be moved. Oh, I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved like a tree planted by the water. I shall not be moved.
Good evening, K-Mud. This is Chip Tipman with the Institute for Sustainable Forestry Hour. Tonight's theme is the hydraulic New Year's Eve party. We're going to be talking about hydrology, water, how it has... it's affecting our local aquatic creatures and how it affects the forests. We have several good guests coming on. First, I want to remind the audience that this is the Institute for Sustainable Forestry, and we are a local nonprofit of over 20 years, and we are always looking for new assistance, new visions, new interests. And our board meetings are always on the third Tuesday of every month. The next board is on October 15th. And if you're interested, at the end of the show, we'll give you the email addresses and the phone numbers to get in touch with us. So any time you are inspired to think about sustainable forestry, think about participating in the board meetings. You can be on a subcommittee. And we're always looking for new people. So first of all, we're going to have Tim Bailey on the line, who's going to introduce our show tonight, hydraulic New Year's Eve party. Tim, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Chip. Good to hear from you.
Great. Well, thanks for putting this together. You want to give us a little idea of who's coming on and... the Eel River Critical Zone Observatory. That sounds like a real interesting place. So who are they and what are they doing?
We have three guests tonight. First, we're starting off with David Drawley and Jesse Hamm, who are work with the Eel River Critical Zone Observatory that is based out of the Angelo Reserve, that is UC Berkeley's facility in the southern end of the South Fork Eel watershed. But they've grown their ambitions to cover more and more interesting landscapes, and they are really doing some cutting-edge work, giving us a better vision of how water flows through our landscape. And then they will be followed by Marian Mayday, who is a eminent USGS geomorphologist who has been studying Redwood Creek for several decades and has done some of the best sediment tracking work in the watershed. But she is going to be leading an ISF field tour in Redwood Creek and Prairie Creek later this month, or next month, sorry. To start off, I guess we should... open with Jesse and David. They're recent PhD students and postdocs with the Eel River Critical Zone Observatory. They've worked with Bill Dietrich and Mary Power in... do we have them on the line?
Hi, Tim.
Yeah.
This is Jesse.
Hey, David here.
Oh,
hey,
good.
Jesse. Hey, David.
Great. Thanks for joining us on the ISF Hour.
Thank you. Yeah, we're happy to be here.
Yeah, well, in order to kick off our celebration for the hydrologic new year, we thought we should, gather some of the kind of most the deepest thinkers on the hydrology of our region. And it's been such a great honor to have so many people associated with Critical Zone Observatory to come and spend time looking at landscapes that many people within the KMUD listening area would recognize.
Tim, if I could break in just a minute, if you could explain what the Critical Zone Observatory is. I understand there's several of them around the country, and we have one in the Eel River watershed. Maybe give a little explanation on what that is. David could do that, or Jesse, somebody, just so that the audience can understand how significant this Angelo Preserve is that UC Berkeley is helping to operate.
Yeah, would either of you like to take that one?
Sure, I can try. So the Eel River Critical Zone Observatory really took off in 2014, and it's a National Science Foundation-funded research program that's based out of Berkeley, but is situated in the Angelo Coast Range Reserve in Mendocino County. And what is the critical zone? That's a great question. It's defined as this region on Earth that's really important for sustaining life, and it extends from the top of the tree canopy downward through the soil and also into the underlying weathered bedrock down to the base of the actively circulating groundwater and the transition into really fresh bedrock. And the idea behind the critical zone is that it integrates all of these different Earth processes that are important. And what I think that's reflected in the variety of disciplines from researchers from Berkeley who are working on the problem. There are tree physiologists and fish biologists, atmospheric scientists, microbiologists, geomorphologists, who are all coming together to try to understand this near-surface part of the Earth as an integrated system working together, and that only through a holistic lens can we really understand what's going on.
What a great introduction. So, Tim, I'll let you take it away.
Well, and would either of you like to address how it's the Critical Zone Observatories are being developed in parallel across the country with the other Critical Zone Observatories? And specific about the Eel River Critical Zone Observatory?
I can talk a little bit about that. Jesse defined the Critical Zone as this kind of near-surface layer of the planet where all these different things that matter for sustaining life are kind of stored, like water and nutrients and different things that are important for ecosystems. And so the collection of critical zone observatories across the country, all of which are funded by the NSF, they're all asking questions related to this kind of near-surface critical zone kind of region of the planet, but they all have different emphasis. And so the Eel River CZO, the Critical Zone Observatory, we would say maybe is really focused on subsurface water storage and how the kind of geological structure underground and the types of rock and the types of soil, how they play a really important role in determining how water is stored and how it's released for streams and for forests, especially in the dry season. Other CZOs are focused on different kind of science questions. So, for example, there are critical zone observatories in more arid parts of the country, like Arizona, that are really focused on kind of the arid kind of hydrology. There are critical zone observatories on the East Coast that are underlain by really disturbed landscapes, like, for example, in Illinois, there's a critical zone observatory in a really intensively managed farmscape. And so the unifying kind of theme is the critical zone, but the kind of different ways we can look at it are framed by all these CZOs that are in different settings that sort of enable them to answer different questions.
When the Eel River Critical Zone Observatory was conceptualized, what was the central theme that was identified?
I think it's focused around trying to understand how water, nutrients, and energy flow through hill slopes and make their way to the oceans. And that's a big question. Some of the more specific regional questions that we were interested in were, where do the trees that inhabit the north coast get their water from in the summer dry season? Where does the base flow that we find in our streams when it hasn't rained for many months come from? How does the fact that water is stored below ground in this region impact the drought resilience of our forests as we move between really wet years and dry years? And what is it that controls the habitat of streams in terms of the temperature and the amount of water that might impact fish distribution? And the backdrop for this is, all of your listeners, I'm sure, are aware, is the local Mediterranean climate in the area. And what's really important about the Mediterranean climate is that water comes in the wet season, and the energy for primary production and for growth of plants and animals primarily comes in the dry season. And because of that offset, because there's a six-month lag between when the water comes and when energy is available to make use of that water, the role of the subsurface as a storer of water is amplified in this particular landscape.
Interesting. And have you looked at the diversity of landscapes within the larger Eel River watershed, and are you finding different responses?
Yeah, so the Eel River Critical Zone Observatory is really focused on two sort of north-south running geological formations that are part of the Franciscan Formation in the northern coast of California. And these two geological formations have very different underlying rock types. And some of the listeners might be familiar with, for example, the stretch of 101 between Cloverdale and Hopland. This particular piece of the North Coast landscape is underlain by a type of rock that, when it weathers and when it stores water in the subsurface, it's unable to kind of store as much water due to the way it weathers and is affected by climate. Then the rocks kind of to the west, which are part of this other north-south running geological belt, that have a deeper weathering profile and are able to store significant amounts of water. And so we see in those landscapes much denser forests. The listeners are probably familiar with really dense stands of Douglas fir and hardwoods like madrone and oak that make up some of these more western kind of situated watersheds.
So I gather we're celebrating the hydraulic New Year's Eve. So explain how that is. This is just the 1st of October. So what's the New Year's Eve business?
The idea is that the hydrologic calendar is organized around when the water comes rather than our regular calendar. And so October 1st is the typical start of the wet season and when the rains return in the fall. And so that's the idea, that this is the new year.
Okay, so we're starting a new year. Can you summarize how we've been in the last year? It seems like, have we eclipsed the drought that had descended on us the 2 years previous?
Yeah, so this year in terms of rainfall was pretty average in terms of the total. So the, you know, kind of the percentages of total rainfall are hovering around anywhere between 90% of average and about 110% of average. So not a lot of unexpected volume on the upper end or lower end, but the way that the water was distributed, the way the precipitation arrived this winter was maybe a little unique in that we got a couple of really late wet season rainstorms. So, for example, we had a couple late rainfalls in May that led to pretty elevated volumes of water in the subsurface late in the wet season that has resulted in elevated stream flows that have persisted throughout the North Coast throughout this dry season.
since the establishment of the Critical Zone Observatory, is this was this a unique distribution of rainfall for the in this period?
I think since the late May rain was a little unique, yeah. And we should say that a lot of thinking about rainfall and how it arrives, when it arrives, is a really important theme for our critical zone, and in particular how the subsurface stores that rainfall and sort of acts as a middleman between when the rain arrives and when ecosystems are really productive in the summer. And climate scientists, folks that their job is to predict how rainfall and temperature might change in the future under different emission scenarios, for example, they're predicting generally that the mean rainfall in Northern California, sort of the expected volume of water that we might see from year to year, isn't projected to change in any really significant way, but that the seasonal patterns of rainfall arrival are expected to change. And the way that this is kind of amplified is that the rainfall is more expected to arrive during the peak of the wet season. So during the peak wet season months of December, January, February, we expect a bit of intensification of rainfall and perhaps a little bit of a drop off in the fall and the spring shoulder season. So not so much of a change in the totals, but maybe a change in the way that that total volume of rain is distributed over the course of the year.
CalADAPT is a climate forecast facility. Can you explain what CalADAPT is and how that is affecting the predictions that you're just talking about, and how do they go about doing their predictions?
Jim, we might let you answer that one.
So CalADAPT is a facility that the last governor, Brown, established as part of his climate mitigation strategy, and they've worked on downscaling 20 different global climate models to address, like, regional climate forecasts. And one of the people particularly associated with it on the North Coast is Ted Grantham from UC Berkeley, who is one of the significant authors in the recent North Coast climate the most recent North Coast climate analysis. But there has been numerous forecasts that have alluded to what Jesse and David have spoken of anticipating higher magnitude flows, hotter temperatures, and more concentrated storm flows, and potentially shorter, more intense wet seasons as one of the dominant themes in the forecast through the rest of the 21st century. But it's a great resource, and people can go to it's CalADAPT with there's Cal with a hyphen adapt.org, and you can basically generate a variety of climate forecasts where you can choose which ensemble, global ensemble model you want to follow, and assign it to essentially a 6x6 square kilometer pixel. So you can pick up some relatively small regional climate variation from that's basically interpolated from these, like, large-scale global climate models. And so it's a really nice resource for getting what the current kind of state-of-the-art, prospects for our climate into about 2100. Unfortunately, I think with the political situation we're in now, it's possible that CalADAPT has basically underestimated how poorly our society is actually going to adapt to climate. And so the most serious case that they contemplate is as usual emission scenario. And so I think there actually may be some very realistic downsides that are just not captured within the existing within the model that they're giving the public access to.
Vegetation management and stream flow enhancement, is that something that you guys address, and how does that affect forest sustainability?
That's a great question. So we have made some advancement in our understanding of how these trees are using water in the area. And we don't have the full story yet, but I can tell you the discoveries that we have made. The first is that question, where do the trees in the summer get their water from? When we've measured tree water use, we see that the forests in our area continue to use water all summer long, even into September, when it hasn't rained at that point for many months. And the observation that we've made is that there are soils on hill slopes that are typically pretty thin, maybe a few feet thick, and those tend to dry out by early July. However, there's a thick zone of bedrock that lies beneath the soil, and anyone who's driven along and seen a road cut has seen these thin soils and the bedrock underneath. And the roots of the trees penetrate into that bedrock. And what we've seen is that the bedrock is actually supplying about 3 times more moisture to the forest than the soil over the summer dry season. And it's this rock moisture that's actually sustaining the tree water use all summer long. Now,
I just want to stress, too, that the rock moisture Jesse is mentioning is different in a lot of ways than groundwater, where groundwater is this saturated, deeper water source. This moisture source that he's referring to is not fully saturated. It's more like a slightly wet sponge,
a film on fractures in the rock.
And that means that the trees, at least on the upper parts of the landscape, are not necessarily digging their roots directly into the groundwater that feeds the stream. Instead, they're accessing this moisture from this sort of previously underrepresented and kind of underexplored region of the subsurface.
But you've asked exactly the right question. Does tree water use in the summer detract from water that would otherwise end up in the stream? And I would say that the jury is still out on that at the moment in our field sites, and that we are continuing to work on that problem and think about how the distribution of roots and trees into this wetted bedrock impacts how the water is flowing and ending up in the stream.
How about the size of the trees? Does that seem to matter? There was a study a few years ago by Andy Stubblefield from HSU, who I believe was saying that the younger fir tree, the younger conifers, were sucking a great deal more water than the older ones. Is that research being held true by your research?
I don't know if we've specifically collected enough data to ask that question. The one thing that we have seen is that the Douglas fir water use tends to taper more in the summer than the hardwoods. And the hardwoods are a little more pedal to the metal all summer long in terms of how much water they're using. And what that finding leads to is a conclusion that if the forest were to convert to primarily Douglas fir, likely as a result of fire suppression, that there may be overall less tree water use in the summer dry season, and that declined evaporation of water from the leaf surfaces of a Douglas fir forest may actually amplify some of the warming, because there's a cooling effect when the trees sweat, and the hardwoods tend to sweat longer into the summer.
Well, that leads to one of our major, I guess, management problems in our larger bioregion is conifer encroachment on long-established hardwood stands. And I wonder if you could comment on the overall climate adaption of the hardwood stands in comparison to, these young stands as we look at the prospects of a significantly warming climate.
That's another great question. It is the case that it seems like the Douglas fir are taking over in many of the forests, and you can see young saplings coming up under the hardwoods. And after a certain amount of time, they can overtop and emerge from the canopy and shade out the hardwoods, and the hardwoods are less adapted to shade, and so they die off. One of the things that may alter that in a warmer future is the fact that in the pollen record that we see when we look back in time, during warmer periods, the hardwoods tend to be a little more dominant, and that's likely because they have they're a little bit better adapted to water stress and to heat stress than the conifers. I think that there are still active management questions that we need to be thinking about in the very near future, and what the composition of the forests we want to see, what kind of forests we'd like to see. And that's a really intricate question with lots of moving parts, I would say.
I have to ask you a really dumb question, but there were realtors in this area back 30 years ago who were saying, when a prospective purchaser of rural land was asking, well, where's the water come from? And he said, oh, well, it comes from the Sierras, and it goes underneath the Sacramento Valley, and it comes bubbling up here. Now, that's certainly folly. Is that not correct?
Yeah, so our understanding of hill slopes on the North Coast, or at least in our study areas, and how they store water is that basically at a depth ranging from about 2 or 3 meters to about 30 meters, there's essentially an impermeable fresh layer of bedrock. And so that means that for the most part, the vast majority of water cycling and the storage and transport of water underground in our North Coast watershed is kind of trapped, kind of closed off from the bottom. And so there's a deeper impermeable layer where water is not necessarily exchanging with deeper sources on any kind of time scale that's commensurate with seasonal sort of wetting and drying. And so yeah, the majority of water that's extracted, primarily from wells or other sources in the springs or streams, is water that fell in the previous wet season, not water that made its way from maybe a larger sort of regional aquifer or water table system.
Yeah, you can kind of think as in this ridge and valley landscape, each individual hill slope is its own little water tower with its own internal hydrologic cycle. And the water that it leaks out to the stream each year is water that fell as rain on that individual hill slope. We don't see evidence for very large regional water motion. Every single hill slope that makes up a watershed is gaining water and losing water to the stream each year.
Very good description. Thank you. Tim, you have more to say?
Well, getting back to our central theme of this being the hydrologic new year, as I understand it, the Eel River Critical Zone Observatory is up for reauthorization or refunding or renewal. And I'm curious what what you guys are looking towards, and you know who your partners are as you look for the next round of work in this watershed.
Yeah, so we definitely want to keep our work going on the North Coast, but we're also looking to expand our thinking a little bit and take some of the questions and some of the lessons that we've learned from Northern California to new sites. And so we're working really closely with Daniela Rempe, who's a hydrogeologist at University of Texas Austin and also a graduate from the PhD program at UC Berkeley, and Jenny Druhan, who is a scientist at University of Illinois, to expand some of our study sites. So we're hoping to reapply for Critical Zone Observatory funding and to take our show on the road. So one of the new places we're hoping to look at is farther east of our current sites. So these are also Coast Range watersheds in Northern California, but closer to Williams, California, which is kind of near the Central Valley. And in a lot of ways, the subsurface structure and geology is comparable to our current sites, but there's a lot less rain that falls in these watersheds. And so that's a kind of a tuning knob that we're hoping to play with and explore how do these landscapes behave and how do they store water and how does water get to the stream and trees when there's significantly less rainfall. Maybe Jesse can describe one of the other sites that we're looking at in Colorado and how it plays into this story too.
Yeah, we're also trying to think about the role of snow, and that's why we're in Colorado. One of our big resolutions, though, is to really try to understand the extent to which water storage and bedrock or rock moisture is a global phenomenon and the extent to which it's important across the globe for trees. And I'll just mention that all of these climate models that are being used to predict the future state of our hydrologic cycle and the Earth's temperature, they're really focused only on the soil. And that's not because they don't think bedrock's important, but we have a really poor understanding of how important bedrock is in many different landscapes. And so one of the themes as we broaden the locations that we're looking at is to characterize the extent to which water stored in bedrock is important for forest health and forest resilience at all these new sites, and to bring that field-based understanding to the modelers so that they can better parameterize their models and improve on the predictions that they're making.
Speaking of bedrock, there is a bedrock of non-scientific evidence that is trying to say that most of what you've been talking about the last half hour is not true, and that there really is no climate change happening, and that there really is no urgency to the state of our climate that Greta Thunberg is promoting. How do you respond to those naysayers? And is there any convincing evidence that would then bring some of those bedrock, hard rock, non-climate change people? How do we address them?
That's a great and challenging question.
Jesse and I are looking at each other with puzzled eyes.
I mean, one fun observation, this is not going to change the whole world's mind, but that is that the greenhouse effect in and of itself, if it were not present, the Earth would be frozen and uninhabitable. So that's a simple energy balance argument that you can make, that one, we only have the warm temperatures that we have to begin with because of the greenhouse effect. And I think once you start to appreciate the science behind that, you can understand that the addition of more carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas increases that insulating property and traps more infrared heat that's leaving the Earth. But again, that's a really challenging question. I think I'm not sure of the right answer.
Well, we'll give you till our next interview, next show, and let you answer that. I wanted to remind the listeners, this is KMUD. This is the Institute for Sustainable Forestry Hour. And we want to thank KMUD for allowing us to air this kind of information. And we will open up the lines in about 10 minutes for anyone who's interested to call in. And that number is 923-3911. And we have another guest on the air. And I'm hoping, David, you and Jesse will hang on and join us when Marianne Mayday is joining us. Marianne, are you on the line now?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you very much for joining us. And you are retired from the U.S. Geologic Survey. And
that's right.
And maybe introduce yourself a little bit and tell us about October 13th, what's happening on October 13th.
Well, I will back up to today for starters. I've been studying mostly Redwood Creek in Humboldt County for many decades, and today I just recently got out of the field. I spent the day walking down Redwood Creek with survey notes from 20 years ago and air photos and other photos from 20 years ago to see what changes I've seen. And there's good news and there's bad news. Some of the good news is the first part of the hike, I was seeing deeper pools, lots of scour around large wood, not much algae compared to our drought years. The sediment is coarser. And what's interesting is the creek in this particular reach has been cutting through sediments that were deposited in floods from the 1960s and 70s and even 1997. So it's a good sign that some of this excess sediment is being flushed downstream. And as it's getting flushed out, we're actually exposing boulders and large wood that had been buried in the channel, and it's now making what we call channel complexity. It's increasing the complexity of the channel. But then as we walked farther down the channel, we got into a reach of very low complexity, a lot more sedimentation, shallow pools, tributaries which were coming into Redwood Creek, which are disconnected. There's so much sediment built up at their mouths. There's no running water, flowing water, from the tributaries into the creek.
Marianne, if I could interrupt just a minute, can you identify exactly which Redwood Creek that is? Because we have a Redwood Creek.
Okay, Redwood Creek in Redwood National Park. I know,
in
there's like too many Mill Creeks, too many Redwood Creeks.
Right. Okay, so this is the one up in northern Humboldt in Redwood National Park. Great.
Correct,
we'll continue.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, no, sorry. I forgot that, yeah, you folks have your own Redwood Creeks down there, too. So there are reaches that are beginning to recover from past damage from logging and other reaches that are still impacted decades later from that damage. The other thing that really struck me today that I hadn't seen 10 years ago was that I think every tan oak I saw in the riparian zone was dead or dying from sudden oak death. And so that's a new threat to our system that we hadn't identified 10 or 20 years ago. And I don't know at this point what that's going to do to food webs and bank stability and fire hazard, but we have a lot of dead trees along the creek edge right now. So that brings me to what's happening on October 12th. I agreed to take a field trip out to look at Prairie Creek, which is pretty much a pristine redwood, old-growth redwood forest stream, and one of its tributaries, Lossman Creek. And then compare and contrast it to Redwood Creek, which is just a few miles away. And I liken it to going to a doctor's office for a checkup. You know, what do they take? They take your pulse, your weight, your blood pressure, your cholesterol. You know, so what does a geomorphologist look at? You know, we have our own ways of measuring river health. And so that's what the field trip is going to be. How do we measure the vital signs of a river to look at whether it's healthy or not? And it's everything from water temperature to how much sediment is in the river, the size of the sediment, and how it's arranged. It's what we call the architecture of the stream channel. We look at the riparian condition, how much wood is in the stream, how much algae is in the stream, channel width, channel depth. So these are the kinds of things we're going to be looking at the field, on the field trip, to say, well, what can you tell about the watershed and the stresses on the stream by looking at these vital signs that we're looking in the stream right in front of us? Does that make sense?
Yes, that's very good description, and I misspoke earlier saying that it was October 13th. It's actually October 12th is Saturday, the field trip to Prairie Creek. And if anyone's interested in registering, there are a few positions left, and if you are interested, you should take your pencil and piece of paper, and I'll give you the email address with whom you can register. So anything further you'd like to say about that, Marianne? It sounds like a very interesting trip.
Just that we do have to limit the number of people because we don't want to damage our stream banks with 40 people trampling on it. So unfortunately, we do have to limit the amount of people on the trip. But I do look forward to meeting some of your members and other members of the public.
And the place that you would register is with the following email address. That is S. Noland. The spelling is SNOLAN at Humboldt1.com. That's S. Noland at Humboldt1, the number, .com. And you can also register at the Institute for Sustainable Forestry. Our phone number is 707-244-4584. And the email address is contact.newforestry@gmail. And our website is www.instituteforsustainableforestry.com. Tim, would you like to break in or maybe...
One thing I just would like to comment on is how significant Marianne's work on Redwood Creek is, because USGS has basically, with Marianne leading this program for several decades, had one of the most comprehensive surveillances of a watershed going through a radical change in sediment behavior, and the Redwood Creek watershed has undergone one of the most ambitious restoration attempts, but also one of the most violently damaged watersheds around. And the scientific work that's now, you know, more than a generation of people working on that project is really important. And Marianne's work in particular has been phenomenal. And detecting these like long-term trends of the river readjusting to its new circumstances. So I think it's going to be a very exciting trip.
So
thank you, Tim, for those words.
if anybody would like to call in and address either of our guests, David Draley or Jesse Helm or Marianne, they're welcome to call in now. David and Jesse, I'm wondering if any of this information that Marianne is giving us rings true to you with your studies on the upper reaches of the Eel River.
So, yeah, we're also really interested in in-channel processes. I will highlight a study by Guy Lovell, who is a master's student at Berkeley, and he really focused on the two watersheds that make up the natural laboratory that we study at the Eel River Critical Zone Observatory, which are two watersheds from these different geological formations. And Sky really looked at how the extent of wetted channel network, which is sort of the length of the river channel that actually has water in it, how it changes over the course of a dry season, and in particular, how the different properties of the subsurface affect the amount of water in the channels over the dry season. So his study was a really good demonstration of how important the critical zone is for determining the extent and quality of fish habitat and the sort of in-channel conditions that we know are really important for aquatic ecosystems.
Yeah, the general finding is that the bigger the sponge on the hill slope, the more the bedrock is weathered, the more water and groundwater it will store to then leak out over the summer into the channels. And so we see much greater wetted channel extents, or the length of the flowing stream network, in places that have more bedrock weathering. The caveat, and this ties in a little bit to what Marianne was talking about, is if there is a lot of sediment in the channel in some of these areas, particularly around Casper Creek and on the coast, we see that the water can flow through that sediment instead of being up on the surface, and that can disconnect the channel and have important consequences for the aquatic ecosystem.
You know, one thing I wanted to bring up about Sky's work is that at ISF, one of the things that we've really thought a lot about is trying to empower people who are like smaller land managers to really get to know their landscapes and collect data that is meaningful. And Sky essentially walked these watersheds on a weekly basis and observed the contraction of the wetted channel. And it's kind of come up that that is maybe the easiest and most effective way to essentially map the summer hydrology of some of our watersheds without being able to, you know, if we can't get flow meters or other kinds of instrumentation. Basically, if you have a relatively good map of your landscape, you can identify where, you know, where at a given time the you know, the perennial reaches are where reaches are wet. And so I think that, you know, we, one of the things we're really encouraging is people to kind of just start collecting notes and start building profiles of what is happening in the environment that they know best and maybe no one else ever gets to. There's a lot of places in southern Humboldt, northern Mendocino, where only a few people ever go. And so I think, you know, we really want to empower the community to observe their landscape and potentially use that information to modify their behavior or potentially the trajectory of the forest around them.
And we had a caller call in that didn't want to go on the air, and Garth's going to give us the question.
Yeah, they had a question about, they weren't quite understanding how the larger trees don't use as much water as the smaller trees. I wonder if you could kind of go into that a little more.
I mean, I can take one comment. Jesse mentioned that this is not something that we've collected really any specific data on, looking at the differential water use of trees of different size, but it's kind of known that younger forests sometimes can use more water because of the fact that they're growing. And so larger established forests oftentimes have, despite the fact that maybe an individual tree might use a significant volume of water, there may be less trees for particular area. So 1 acre might have, you know, a couple of big trees on it as opposed to a lot of really small trees that are growing quickly and potentially using large volumes of water. I'm not saying that that is what's necessarily happening at our sites or in any particular area, but that's one way that over a landscape, the larger forest might actually in effect be using less water than the smaller sort of growing forest.
I'd put a call out to our listening audience. If anybody knows the Andy Stubblefield research that was done several years ago through HSU, and his research was, I believe, had to do with that very subject, and possibly somebody could call in with more information than I have to answer the caller's question.
I think there's a huge amount of work on this specific topic, and there's kind of very different results that are coming out of different landscapes, and so I think it's actually really hard to generalize. And I think it's one of the biggest management questions for restoration forestry is, you know, how do we approach forests that where we expect to have growing water stress and growing water demands, the traditional industrial forestry model has basically results in overstocked stands that are particularly stressed by competition between neighbors. And so I think this is one of the big questions that I think there is going to have to be a lot of different kinds of answers to.
Another issue that, Mary Ann, you just brought up about the dead tan oaks on the border of the riparian zones, I'm very distressed to hear that, because that's the same thing that's happening in southern Humboldt, and the Institute for Sustainable Forestry was founded by Jan Iris, whose principle was that we wanted to be able to utilize some of the local hardwoods that were also acorn producing and food producing, but the local hardwoods, particularly the tan oak, was a species that he wanted to promote, and ISF is still trying to promote through Whitethorn Construction, where they have mills. And the loss of this tan oak, what's going to happen, and how do we deal with it? Anybody can hit that question up?
Yeah, I'm not a botanist, so I'm not going to address that. It was just very striking to see the amount of dead trees out on the landscape.
David or Jesse, do you have any comment on the sudden oak death?
I am not an expert in sudden oak death, no.
Okay, well, we'll leave that for another show, because it certainly is showing itself in many of the watersheds, and I know that the UC Ag Extension, Jana Valikovic, is very much up to date on it and is interested in trying to find where the pathogen is traveling, what its effect is going to be, and is it getting into other oaks besides just the tan oak and some of the other oaks. Tim, do you have anything more to say about that?
Well, I mean, I'm not technically engaged with the sudden oak death story, but I've seen it in landscapes that it's really emotionally affecting sometimes. I mean, it seems to be patchy, and it seems to grow at wildly different rates between different years. But it's, at this point, there are so many landscapes around that are heavily affected by it. It's going to dramatically change the trends of our forests. I'm deeply concerned, and I don't see any good solutions. You know, I think there's a lot of what I hear is people are tracking it, and there have been some treatments, but for the most part, I think. It's almost like I personally feel like powerless before it.
Well, Marianne, on October 12th, we should be able to see some of the effects of the sudden oak death, and maybe on the walk there will be some more knowledgeable experts who can fill us in on what the effect is and what the effect will be on this sudden oak death and how that it's moving across our region.
Yeah, I hope we'll be able to see some of that. It depends on how far we can walk. I hope the weather holds out and we can have a good hike.
So I wanted to remind the audience that this is the Institute for Sustainable Forestry Radio Hour, and we have on the line David Draley and Jesse Halm from UC Berkeley and the Eel River Critical Zone Observatory. And we have Marianne Mayday, who's retired from the U.S. Geologic Service, and we invite anybody who wants to call in and talk about the hydrologic New Year's Eve party that we're having today, which is the beginning of the new hydrologic year.
So I guess, does anyone have any... ambitions for the new hydrologic year that they would like to discuss, like thoughts on next moves? And
yeah, we were talking about this before the show, wondering sort of what some nice resolutions and commitments might be for the upcoming water year. And one thing that we're really interested in doing is at our study watersheds is using different isotope techniques for water. So water, when it arrives as rainfall, can be heavier or lighter depending on the isotopic composition of that collection of water molecules. So depending on how many neutrons a water molecule might have, it can be heavier or lighter. And so you can use these kind of unique isotopic fingerprints in rainfall events to kind of fingerprint rainfall events and track those rainfall events through a watershed. And one of our hydrological New Year's resolutions is using some of that water tracking, using some of those techniques to estimate how old is the water that's coming out in the stream. So is the age of the water, is it the rain that fell towards the end of the wet season that's coming out in the stream at the end of the dry season? Is it a mixture of all the water that falls over the course of the wet season? So using some of these kind of novel geochemical and isotope methods to fingerprint these rainfall events and follow them as they move through the landscape.
That's just fascinating. I'm excited to think of the results of those studies that you guys do. That'll be wonderful to hear from you.
Jesse, do you have any hydrological New Year's resolutions?
I mean, like I said before, I'm excited to try to translate some of the really exciting field-based discoveries that we've made in the Eel River watershed to the larger scientific community to try to emphasize the importance of the critical zone and of the weathered bedrock as a sponge that can store water and its critical importance to the trees and to the streams in our region. It's really an underappreciated zone, the weathered bedrock. It's hard to measure in many places, and that's why it hasn't been done. It took a lot of drilling and years of monitoring for us to begin to wrap our head around its significance in the hydrologic cycle. But what we've learned is that it's really important in regulating how rain becomes runoff and how rain becomes water for trees. And so I hope to kind of champion the importance of the subsurface, that deeper subsurface below the water, to the broader scientific community, and hope to motivate them to do more studies like the ones we've been doing in Mendocino County and at other places around the globe.
And I'll also just stress that the Eel River Critical Zone Observatory has been, in terms of the exploration of the deeper subsurface and this weathered rock zone that Jesse is referring to, has been a real success story in terms of exploration of this deeper region of the planet's near surface layers. And it served as a real proof of concept for exploring some of these new sites in Williams, California and Colorado. And so, yeah, we're looking forward to branching out and exploring new places and using some of the things that we've learned from our study so far on the Eel and in new places.
So, David and Jesse, can you give the listening audience any contact information if they're interested in finding out more about the Eel River Critical Zone Observatory and the work that's happening at the Angelo Preserve? Can you give any information out on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the easiest way is probably to use Google and look for the Angelo Coast Range Reserve or the Eel River Critical Zone Observatory. I'll note that Angelo is open to the public if people want to visit. They park on the outside, but there's beautiful hikes within the reserve, and there's beautiful rivers, and there's old-growth forest. And so I would encourage people to come visit.
Thank you. And Mary Ann, is there a way to get in touch with the kind of work that you've been doing?
I'm actually finishing up a summary report of 40 years of geomorphic research in Redwood National Park, and so that should be available to the public in 2 or 3 months, and so that would be available through Redwood National Park, and again, Google is a wonderful tool to check on that, but that's not quite ready for prime time yet.
Well, I do appreciate all three of you being on the show with us. Tim, would you like to say anything more?
Yeah, well, just from ISF's position, it's really invaluable for like people like you three to participate with, and engage with communities that don't necessarily have access to the kind of scientific capacity that, some of I think transferring the information that all three of you have been developing into and creating the kind of a management wisdom from this
the scientific work is a really important goal, and I really want to thank you all for participating in this evening, because I think, you know, if we are going to deal with our severe forestry problems